Translation: Maitreya continued, O best of the Kuru dynasty, I shall now describe before you the descendants of Shyambhuva Manu, who was born of a part of a plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Please repeat. Maitreya continued, O best of the Kuru dynasty, I shall now describe before you the descendants of Shyambhuva Manu, who was born of a part of a plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Lord Brahma is a powerful expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although Brahma is Jiva Tattva, he is empowered by the Lord, and therefore he is considered a plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sometimes it happens that when there is no suitable living being to be empowered to act as Brahma, the Supreme Lord himself appears as Brahma. Brahma is the plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Shyambhuva Manu was the direct son of Brahma. The great sage Maitreya is now going to explain about the descendants of this Manu, all of whom are widely celebrated for their pious activities. Before speaking of these pious descendants, Maitreya has already described the descendants of impious activities, representing anger, envy, unpalatable speech, quarrel, fear and death. Purposely, therefore, he is next relating the history of the life of Dhruva Maharaj, the most pious king within this universe. Dhruva Maharaj leaves home. So this is the story of Dhruva Maharaj. And here, this actually took place long, long ago, during the time of Shatrayug, right after the creation. Brahma created this universe, and Lord created the universe, but Brahma engineered to do the interior decoration of the universe, to arrange all the things that were needed for the functioning of the universe, and Brahma engineered that activity, and then Brahma created a Manu, Shyambhuva Manu. Brahma is known as Shyambhu because Brahma is born from the navel of the Lord. Brahma directly appeared from the Lord. And that's why Brahma is known as Shyambhu, like Shyambhur Narada Sambhu. So Brahma is known as Shyambhu, and the son of Brahma who became the Manu, the first Manu, is called Shyambhuva Manu. And so this Shyambhuva Manu was the grandfather of Dhruva Maharaj. So it is a custom in the Vedic society to establish the lineage of the person they are going to talk about. Generally, when someone was going to talk, so here Dhruva Maharaj's life and activities are going to be described by the sage Maitreya. So before talking about Dhruva Maharaj, Maitreya Rishi is telling who Dhruva Maharaj is. And that's why he is describing who is Dhruva Maharaj's great-grandfather, who is Dhruva Maharaj's grandfather, who is Dhruva Maharaj's father, and then he is coming to describe about Dhruva Maharaj. So this shows that how authentic these Vedic descriptions are. Nowadays people think that the descriptions in the Vedas and Upanishads and Purans, they are simply some imaginary fairy tales. But this is a proof. Anybody can see that this is the proof proof about the authenticity of the Vedic descriptions. Vedas are not describing about some fictitious characters. Vedas are actually describing about the real personalities, and thus describing about these activities of these real personalities. Vedas are helping us to approach the absolute truth. We cannot approach the absolute truth by following a bunch of lies. Can anybody become a wise man by following or mastering some fairy tales? Did anybody ever see that somebody became wise, or not only wise, somebody got the absolute wisdom by reading and researching on Grimm's Märchen? Or Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales? No. That's the difference between the fairy tales and the absolute history. The Vedas are actually describing about the historical personalities, and anybody who reads Vedas with proper guidance and understanding, then he can immediately see that the Vedas are describing about truth and nothing but the truth. We can see that there's such a long history. Before they're talking about here Dhruva Maharaj, who is practically one of the first personalities on this planet, but still they're describing who Dhruva Maharaj is. Dhruva Maharaj's great-grandfather is Brahma. Or rather, great-great-grandfather is Brahma. And his great-grandfather is... great-grandfather is Brahma. His grandfather is Svayambhuva Manu, and his father is King Uttanapad. Now consider any of these the characters in the fairy tales. Do you know about the names of their fathers? Consider some character. You may know the name of the father, but did they ever describe the name of their grandfather? Does anybody know who is the father of Snow White or the seven dwarfs or Hansel or Gretel? No, because they just pick up some character from their mind and they just build up a story basing on that character. But in history you can't do that. But when you read history, then you get the name of the father. Like if somebody asks you, who is Napoleon's grandfather? And if you are an expert historian, then you would know. Yes, Napoleon's grandfather is such and such person. Who is the father of Hitler? Who is the father of Mussolini? Everybody knows. Or at least anybody who studied history knows. Because these personalities are real characters. They are not just some fictitious characters. And this way one gets to understand how great these personalities were and how aristocratic was their lineage. And what to talk about Dhruva Maharaj, even we can go back to our ancestral line. Like, of course, not in our physical body, or the line that gave birth to our physical body, but our spiritual lineage, we can immediately relate. Our father is Prabhupada, our grandfather is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, our great-grandfather is Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj, then his father is Bhakti Vinod Thakur, then Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj. It goes on, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So we can go all the way up to Krishna. So we are coming from the spiritual sky, and our line comes from Krishna. And it is very important to understand that. That's why when one takes to spiritual life, one must link up with certain spiritual family. And there are, generally there are four different families, family lines. The Brahma, Rudra, Shri and Kumar. These are the four Vaishnav Sampradayas. And anybody who wants to go back to Godhead must become linked up with one of these four. And then our line is very, very special because it not only comes out of one of these four lines, but our line has a tremendous personality who came from one of these four sampradayas, that is Brahma Sampradaya, and that is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It is like sometimes we see that there are some big aristocratic families, and they are very, very big. The family line is very famous and very big. And in that family, one person becomes extremely successful, right? And his line becomes very, very special. The same way, our line actually is the line of Brahma, and it comes down to Madhvacharya's line, and then in that line, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, the most wonderful personality. Like all the four sampradayas are there, but in that one of these sampradayas, all of a sudden there was the appearance of a personality brilliant as the sun. Actually, not only brilliant as the sun, he's even more brilliant than billions of suns together. That is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Himself appeared in this line. And that's why in Chaitanya Charitamrita it has been described, Ishwar Puri ke dhanno korilen Sri Chaitanya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu glorified Ishwar Puri. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to glorify Ishwar Puri. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to glorify the sampradaya of Madhvacharya. It is just out of his causeless mercy or out of his transcendental will, Mahaprabhu did that. But generally, we do not have any such direct link with Madhvacharya. Mahaprabhu himself defeated Madhvacharya's followers, Madhvacharya's philosophy. The Madhvas, the Tattvavad, Madhvacharya's followers, they generally, their philosophy is that ultimately one becomes liberated. Not with Shajujya Mukti, but four other kinds of liberation. Sharupya, Shamipya, Shalokya and Shashti. And the goal is to go back to Vaikuntha. That is their ultimate accomplishment. So when Mahaprabhu met them in his tour to South India, he went to Udipi, the place of Madhvacharya, and there he had a discussion with this Acharya of that Sampradaya. And Mahaprabhu asked, what is the ultimate goal of life? And they said, liberation is the ultimate goal of life. Then Mahaprabhu did not accept it. He said, no, that's wrong. In a very humble way. Actually, Mahaprabhu used to defeat everybody in a very humble way. He would not just smash them directly. Mahaprabhu would take up a very humble position and he would question them. And Mahaprabhu began to ask him questions. Well, you are saying mukti is the ultimate goal, but then why it has been said that Mukti Devi herself, the mukti liberation personified, with folded hands, begs a devotee to engage her in some service, to give him some service to render for them. The devotees do not desire mukti or liberation. And Mukti Devi, liberation personified, follows the devotees. So, devotees do not want liberation, but liberation follows the devotees with a folded hand. Please, let me do something for you. And then he quoted another shloka that says that Krishna is telling in Srimad Bhagavatam that even though I offer liberation to my devotees, but my devotees do not accept them. Diyamanam nagrinhanti bina matshevanam jana. My devotees do not want anything. My devotees do not want liberation. That is not favorable for devotional service. So this way Mahaprabhu quoted shlokas from the Bhagavad scriptures. And those people who are actually learned people, so then they immediately understood that what Mahaprabhu was telling was right. And what they were practicing was wrong. Liberation can never be the goal of a devotee's devotional service. Devotional service takes place in a platform beyond liberation. Actually, we have this material nature, and beyond material nature is the region of liberation, and beyond that region of liberation is devotional service. Actually, liberation, the state of liberation is actually like a state of neutrality. When one is neutral, one is neither bound nor engaged in service, then it is the region of liberation. Like graphically we can see this way, that we have the axis 0, and on the left hand side, the left hand side of the axis is minus, and right hand side of the axis is plus, right? Everybody must have done graph. So now 0 is the liberation, the state of liberation, right? And the left hand side of liberation is material nature, right? All minus, the region of negative region. It is all minus. The more you go, the more you become minus, right? The deeper you go, the more negative you become, more bound you become. And then, like for instance, you have a date of say 100,000 Deutschmark. You owe in the market. Now it is negative, right? You're minus 1,000 or 100,000 Deutschmark. Now when you're minus, then your whole concern is how you're going to become, how you're going to square up the debt, right? So then you square up the debt. And when you square up the debt, then you become zero, right? You don't have any more debt. But this zero is not the ultimate goal. Once you have reached the region of zero, then you must go across that region, go beyond that region, and come to the positive direction. Then you, after you have attained the position of zero, then you begin to put money in the bank. Then you are 1,000 mark, 2,000 mark plus, 4,000 marks, 100,000 marks, and it goes on. So same way, when you are materially conditioned, when you are bound by the material nature, then we are in a negative region. We are minus. And deeper we go in the material nature, more minus we become. The more one has in the material nature, it's actually negative. It is not that if in the material nature, if one has $10 million or 10 million Deutschmarks, it doesn't mean that he is actually plus 10 million Deutschmarks. Actually is minus 10 million Deutschmarks. Because he has to become free from this asset that he has. And then he has to come to the point of liberation. That is, he has to become from that region, from that 1 million Deutschmark or 10 million Deutschmarks, he has to become zero. Right? And then that means one has to, first of all, one has to become free from all material attachment, all material assets, from all material bondage. And then reaching the point of zero, then he begins his devotional service. When one becomes totally free from all material bondage, then he begins to render pure devotional service. And then as he renders his service, he increases his bank account in the spiritual sparkase in Golok Vrindavan. So, in the material nature, we are in a negative platform. So, when we are negative, then we try to become neutral. We want to square it up, that no more debts. We square up the debts and come to the point of zero. And after we have reached that point of zero, then we become qualified to have more and more bank accounts in the spiritual bank. That's why it is said that pure devotional service actually begins from Brahma Bhuta platform. Yeah, now let me describe it this way, that this material nature is there, and beyond this material nature is Brahma Jyoti, or the region of Brahma, and beyond the region of Brahma is Vaikuntha, a spiritual sky. So that is the geography of the entire creation. We can see material nature, Brahma Jyoti, and then Vaikuntha Loka. Now, from the material nature, when we want to go to Vaikuntha Loka, then we have to go through this Brahma Bhuta platform. That means the platform when there is no more, when we have no more material bondage. That's why it is said in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying, Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma na sochati na kangshati sama sarveshu bhutesu madbhaktim labhate param. When one attains the Brahma Bhuta platform, when one becomes totally free from material attachments. And how does one become totally free from material attachments? When one realizes that he is actually a spirit soul. When one realizes that he is a spirit soul and he is not this body, then he is situated in the Brahma Bhuta platform. It is not that we physically go into some place called Brahma Bhuta Loka, or Brahma Loka, Brahma Jyoti. No, it is actually a state of consciousness. And when we reach that region of Brahma Bhuta platform, that is when we become totally free from all material attachments by realizing that we are not this material body, then na sochati na kangshati. Then one does not have any hankering for anything, or nor does he have any lamentation for anything that he lost. Jai Shri Shri Radha Madan. The hankering and lamentations are actually for, we hanker for the things that we do not have, and we lament for the things that we have lost. Now, in material nature, we are constantly in this dilemma of hankering and lamenting. We are always craving for something that we do not have, and we are always lamenting for something that we have lost. And that is the material condition. But when one transcends this material condition, then the first symptom is that he does not hanker for anything, and he does not lament for anything. Na sochati, na kangshati, sama sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Then he sees everyone with an equal vision. He does not see different living entities according to their different physical forms. He doesn't consider one to be his body. Neither he considers himself to be his body, nor does he consider others to be their bodies. So he simply sees the spirit soul. And that's why in his eyes, everyone is equal.
He's a real communist. Actually, a transcendentalist is a real communist because he sees everyone equal, not artificially, but naturally. Because he sees that everyone is a spirit soul. And everyone is actually hankering for something spiritual. And that's why he tries to give them everything that one really needs. That is, his spiritual needs are fulfilled by the mercy of a Vaishnava. We offer our prayers, Vancha Kalpa Tarub Bhascha, Kripa Shindhu Bhaye Vacha, Patitanang Pavanibhu Vaishnavibhu Namo. Vancha Kalpa Tarub Bhascha. A Vaishnava has been compared to a desire tree. Now, one may think, actually I used to think in the beginning, then why does the Vaishnava don't give? Why does the Vaishnavas give what we actually want? We don't see Vaishnavas are giving all kinds of things to different people. Like somebody may come and say, that, why don't you give me a Mercedes Benz? But a Vaishnava doesn't give that. Like I didn't see Prabhupada giving anyone a Mercedes Benz or things like that. But then later on I realized the Vaishnava doesn't really give anything material. Vaishnava knows what we actually want and Vaishnava gives. Vaishnava is capable of giving that. And he always gives that, provided we are willing to take that. If you go to a Vaishnava and tell him that give me 100,000 Deutschmarks, then Vaishnava won't give you that. On the other hand, if you have 100,000 Deutschmarks, Vaishnava will try to take it away from you. So be careful of the Vaishnavas. They are dangerous people. So Vaishnava actually takes away our material things and gives us the spiritual assets. That is the position of a Vaishnava. As a matter of fact, Vaishnava is not actually so eager to take material things from people. Actually, what they do, they take material things and transform it into spiritual by engaging that in Krishna's service. Actually, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur is writing that Vaishnava is not interested about the wealth of the karmis. This is actually, this wealth of the karmis is like stool. Actually, the person who has it, he himself should get rid of it. Right? So why should a Vaishnava collect the stool? But the thing is that he does it simply to deliver him from his karma. A person, when he is collecting the assets, making his money, he incurs a lot of sinful activities in order to do that. And then on top of that, his asset becomes a big bondage for him, big attachment for him. So just by offering it to Krishna, he transforms all his karmic all his karma into sukriti, transcendental piety. Like somebody made, say, $1,000, say, 1,000 marks. Now, in order to make the 1,000 marks, he had to go through a lot of difficulties. He had to work very hard. Now, whatever he has done in order to make the $1,000, when that $1,000 is used in Krishna's service, then it becomes, all that work that he rendered, all that he did in order to collect it, is transformed into Krishna's service. So it's an indirect way of engaging people in devotional service. A man, say, worked for 100 hours to get 1,000 Deutschmarks. Right? Now, when the 1,000 Deutschmarks is engaged in Krishna's service, then that 100 hours that he worked becomes 100 hours of devotional service. So that's why the Vaishnavas are engaged in collecting donations. Vaishnavas go from door to door and they collect donations from people. And whatever they collect, although they do not know, they think that, oh, a beggar has come to my door. So give him something and get rid of him. Right? So just they reluctantly, willingly or unwillingly, they may offer some money to that man who has come to the door to collect something. But when he takes it, he offers it to Krishna. And the person where he collected it from, that person gets some transcendental sukriti, transcendental piety. It's actually out of his causeless mercy that Vaishnava goes to collect donations. That's why the occupation of a that person gets some transcendental sukriti, transcendental piety. It's actually out of his causeless mercy that Vaishnava goes to collect donations. That's why the occupation of a Vaishnava has been described as madhukari. You all are familiar with this expression, madhukari. Now, who knows the meaning of this word, madhukari? Good. Yeah. Madhukar means a honey bee. Madhu means honey. And kar means collector. One who collects honey. Actually, Sanskrit names are very meaningful. All Sanskrit words are very meaningful. Every word actually has a root. So, bee, one of the names of the bees is Madhukar. And Madhukar means the collector of honey. So a bee is the collector of honey, that's why a bee is called Madhukar. And the occupation of a honey bee, or a bee, is called Madhukari. Now what does a bee do? Bee goes from flower to flower and collects the honey. And when a bee collects the honey, what he does the bee collect the honey to eat himself? To drink it itself? No. The bee collects the honey and offers it to the king. Of course, for bees, it's queen. The same way we collect, whatever we collect, we don't use it for ourselves. We offer it to our king, Krishna. Right? So that's our occupation. And while the bee is collecting honey, what it does, it transfers pollens, yeah? For, what's it called? Fertilization. Right? What's the expression that that flowers, male flowers and female flowers, I see. So that's what the bee does. Bee goes to collect honey from the flowers. The flowers actually don't have any utility of the honey. They don't really need the honey. Flowers can't really drink it. In natural course, the flower produces the honey. The bee collects it, and in the process, it transfers pollen from flower to flower. And due to that pollen, the flowers become fruits, right? So same way, the flower's life becomes successful just by coming in contact with a bee. The same way, goal of a man's life is not to collect material assets. The goal of his life is to become spiritually situated. And the fructification takes place only when he comes in contact with a Vaishnava. And just by coming in contact with a Vaishnava, he becomes spiritually enlivened, and then he develops a spiritual body. Right? In the flower, we do not see the fruit. The fruit is actually hidden in the flower. The same way our spiritual form is hidden underneath our material body. So when we become spiritually enlivened, then our spirit soul becomes fructified and our spiritual form develops. So that's why it is very important that we come in contact with the devotee, Vaishnava devotee, and have a favorable relationship with him. When we develop a favorable attitude towards the Vaishnava, then automatically our life becomes successful. So, to go back to this point briefly, so here Dhruva Maharaj's stories are going to be, Dhruva Maharaj's activities are going to be revealed, and it has been pointed out that how Dhruva Maharaj came from a very, very famous family. Very big family. Like everybody is proud. Jai Shri Krishna Bhagavan Ki Jai. When someone hails from a big family, he feels very great. And everybody looks at him also with great awe and reverence. Right? Now, everybody wants to become an aristocrat. Right? But everybody has the right to become, to belong to the most elevated, transcendental aristocratic line. One can become the most elevated transcendental aristocrat just by becoming a follower of Lord Chaitanya. Right? Who is more aristocratic than Krishna, the King of Kings? And just by being connected to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, just by being duly initiated by the acharyas of this society, one becomes the most aristocratic person. Not materially, but spiritually. Material aristocracy is just temporary. It doesn't really have any meaning. And it's actually very unfortunate. Like, bigger the family, the more degraded they are. Isn't it? If you go back into the history, you can see that the family of big kings, they're so degraded. Big debauchees, big drunkards. Completely ruthless, didn't have any consideration for anybody. They killed thousands of people without any rhyme or reason. So that is not the real aristocracy. The real aristocracy is in Krishna consciousness. And we are very proud to belong to this family. And we want to increase our line, increase our family. That's why we invite everyone. Why don't you come? And actually, you all have the right to belong to this family. So why don't you come and join us and enjoy the transcendental bliss just by becoming a part of this family. And then, at the time of your death, your father or your grandfather or great-grandfather will come and take you by hand back to the spiritual sky. It's such a wonderful opportunity. Let's try to take full advantage of it. Hare Krishna. Does anybody have any question?
Yeah.
Yes, about spiritual subjects, one may even have doubts, even at liberated stage. Like, it's not that liberated stage means just becoming everything or becoming nothing, right? There is variety even in a liberated stage, right? Like, even in the liberated condition, there are five different mellows, different platforms, right? Brahma Sajujya, then Vaikuntha Prapti, right? And then Vrindavan. And so, although one is situated in chief aspect, right? One is fully cognizant, but still a limited jiva, he has his limitation of perception. And that is revealed by the arrangement of Jogamaya. So it's not, Jogamaya makes arrangements that a living entity, even in Krishna's pastimes or Vishnu's pastimes, sees only certain aspects, right? Otherwise there would not be the question of variety or novelty, right? Actually Jogamaya even bewilders Krishna, right? Jogamaya by her potency even covers Krishna up, right? Of course it is by Krishna's will that she does it, and Krishna forgets things, right? That's why we see that Krishna in Dwarka is lamenting for his friends in Vrindavan. He is yearning to go back to Vrindavan, right? So there is this arrangement in the spiritual nature also, and when one is in such a state, when he is not quite aware of the transcendental reasons and transcendental cause, right, then he must approach the spiritual master or a senior, some elevated personality in the spiritual sky, and clarify his doubts. Yes, exactly. Arjun is a pure devotee of Krishna. So how can there be question? How can there be delusion? How can Arjun be deluded? But by Krishna's arrangement, for the time being, Arjun is bewildered. He is completely overpowered by this grief. And it is an arrangement of Jogamaya so that the world can get Bhagavad Gita. The difference is that there it is just the arrangement of Jogamaya by the sheer desire of Krishna. Whereas in the material nature, it is due to our karmic reaction. Over there it is causeless, but here it has the cause. The cause is karma. But there it is causeless. Nobody can define or describe why it happened, right? Or how it happened. How? Because it's arranged by Jogamaya. And why? Because Krishna wanted it. Otherwise, how can Arjun be deluded? Right? I mean, actually, it's a very nice point. I have seen even devotees, how they overcome grief. Like, other day, about a year, 2 years back, a devotee's father died. He is from England. And his parents, his sister called up Calcutta, and I was there, so she gave me the news that his father or mother died. I think father died. And I was feeling very bad to break the news to him that his father died. And then finally when I told him, he was totally unaffected. He was just lamenting that, it's unfortunate. If I was there, then I could have chanted the holy name and given him Krishna Prasad. Right? So you can see that how devotees become unaffected by grief. And here Arjun, such a great warrior,
right? And a pure devotee of Krishna is breaking down like that.